methodical and the kind of a guy that you want to be around, is what I remember. He never talked much, and he never criticized, but he led. I can tell you, you know, he led by performance. I don't know how much Eris told you about the time that we had to land emergency landing, and we don't know how long that runway was, and we had to make it. It was the only one around. Well, at the end of the runway, there was a 50-foot high granite rock.
Wow.
A smooth surfaced granite rock. But it looked like it was natural. Well, he landed the plane 12 inches away from it.
Wow.
12 inches. And he didn't have all the controls. The other time, we lost the outboard right engine when we had to fly over Vienna twice. That meant that we were in harm's way 2 13-minute periods, because from the initial point of departure to the bombing target, you cannot change elevation or direction. So you're a sitting duck for the anti-aircraft guns, and we try to get away from that by throwing a lot of tinfoil, heavy tinfoil out of the plane, and that kind of jars up their equipment to know how high we are.
Uh-huh.
So, we lost the far right engine. The far left engine came after that. We drove flew all the way home with the two left engines. But as we were making the approach to land, the inboard left engine went and kept turning, however. But there was no power there. And as we touched down, or just about touching down, the fourth engine went. And it was no big deal for him. We started out at there were two parallel runways, with two lanes each. And when we took off at 30-second intervals. And of course, we landed. You land wherever you could. But we started in the right lane. Then, because it was only the left engines, they couldn't keep a steady course. So we went to the left lane of the first runway. Then we went over some grass and got onto the right lane of the second runway. And we ended up on the outboard runway. And that's where we stopped.
Wow.
And as soon as we stopped, he hit the crash bar, which meant that all electrical power is dead, and we got out of there pro haste.
Huh.
So that's one experience. We had an experience where we almost had a mid-air collision before we even took the plane overseas. Well, we didn't take the plane. We took the boat.
Yeah.
But before we checked out, got checked out on a B-24 in Walla Walla, Washington, where we met the rest of our crew, where everybody met each other,
uh-huh.
10 people. And we were flying at dusk time. And I'm sure it's more vivid where you live, where it's a lower flat country, than it was in Walla Walla, Washington, but the ground was black as pitch, and the sky was like a firecracker, so bright. And we were flying west at an elevation that another plane was flying east, right at each other. In moments, those two planes would have exploded and 20 people would have been killed and two airplanes. Well, as it turns out, the instructor for that flight was sitting in the co-pilot seat. That's the right chair. And Dick was sitting in his chair. Well, we were going there, and you know they have lights on the left wing and the right wing. One's blue and one's red. I don't know which is which. But in the co-pilot, really, was standing in the middle between the two chairs, and I was behind him. We're looking straight ahead, and here are those two lights coming at us. And we're looking right at a bright sky, and this black figure coming towards us. Well, at the same time, the co-pilot and your father grabbed the steering wheel and turned it 90 degrees to the left, to the right, which meant that we were now in a vertical position. The wings, the tip of the right wing was facing downward, and the tip of the left wing was facing sky.
Right.
At the same time, the other crew did the opposite of that, and they turned the other way. They turned right like we did, and we ended up, if you can visualize that, by being parallel to each other in vertical form.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Instead of hitting each other horizontally, we bypassed each other vertically.
Wow.
And as soon as that was done, of course, your dad leveled the plane, and there was a moment of silence and personal prayer for those that were ready for that. And we started to breathe after a while.
Huh.
And that's before we even got overseas to do any work.
Wow.
I mean, you know, these guys, did I hear anything about that? Nobody said anything about that. We didn't say, oh boy, did you see what we did? There was none of that nonsense going on. Today, if somebody drops a package and a guy picks it up, you know, did you see me? I picked up a package. I don't understand what's happening. But anyway, that was your father in part.
Wow.
But he was a gentleman. He was a guy that as I say, was comfortable to be around. Always had a little smile on his face. But he led us by performance. That's what I was telling your brother. So I don't know. That's... I understand you're on the... I'll tell you some more if you want.
Oh, I love listening to it.
What did he tell you about the war? How was he able to talk about it?
He didn't really say much to us at all until he was diagnosed with cancer, and then he started writing, and he wrote out all, you know, these memories from childhood and then from the war. And my mom typed them up. And gave each of us a copy of it, you know, mimeographed back there, you know, the way it was. And a few years ago, about 10 years ago, just like 2 days before Christmas, I decided to put it on a website, because then my nieces and nephews and everybody would have access to it, because the copy I had was stuck up in a closet, you know, and I read it once and then never saw it again. And so I made a website that's still out there, and I would love to have you go look at it. He's got your name on there as the navigator from Chicago. Were you from Chicago?
Yes, I was.
Yeah, well, he talks about his training to become a pilot and then going overseas, and he has a picture of the crew.
Uh-huh.
And... he talks about being shipped out and taking the boat over there. And then he mentions how he, Baker, was the crew chief, and he got called home for 2 or 3 weeks because of sickness and death of his father, and you guys lost him as a crew member, and he tried to get him back, but instead they got somebody else, and then this kid was killed. And then he said the radio operator kept feigning sickness every time we went up because he didn't want to go overseas. So he was replaced with a Sergeant Al Offendahl or something like that.
Yes, Offendahl. Yes, I don't have the paper in front of me, but wait a minute, hold on. I got it right here. right here. Any day now. Any day now. Here it is. This is it here. No? Yes? Oh, that's the wrong one. Yeah, here. Yeah. Let's see. Whistler, Hazy, Yanuzi, Cooper. Bailey, Vance, that's all it was. Let's see. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 4 is 10. Yeah. We had a guy by that name, that German name, but I can't remember exact pronunciation.
He said I don't think my dad liked him very well. He said he was a screw-off and a lover of ratings.
Okay.
And he said, we finally finished our training and were shipped down to Hamilton Field, San Francisco, California, for the final staging. And we were then put on an overseas troop train bound for the East Coast and overseas. And then he talks...
You didn't talk about Walla Walla, Washington?
Let's see.
That's where we met our crew.
Yeah, he says...
I was describing that experience in Walla Walla. But anyway, listen, things get... Our memory gets screwed up sometimes.
Oh, he does mention that... here's what he said. I like your description better. He says, one night we were on a training mission and were coming in for a landing, but at that field... We had to make a pass over the field right down the runway we were going to land on. My co-pilot was standing up behind the instructor, and he saw another plane bearing down on us at a 90-degree angle. He just reached over and pushed the control forward to keep us from colliding with the other plane.
Oh.
So he's not very dramatic with it. I like yours better.
Yeah, well, I remember that very well, believe me. At any rate, okay. So you got that all down. When did Dick pass on?
In 1991, I think. Let me.
Oh.
I can tell you here. Whoops. And my son is a pilot now in the Air National Guard.
Really?
Yeah.
Great.
He flies the tanker refuelers. Yes, he passed away on October 22nd, 1991.
91. Now, that's 91-01.
That'd be 20 years ago.
20 years?
Oh. Yeah.
Huh?
20 years ago.
20 years ago.
Doesn't seem possible. I have a picture of your little houses that you had over in Italy.
All right, right. We built them.
Yeah, that's what he said. And he has he talks about some of the missions that he went on and flying doing some of the German Regensdorf, Germany. And he talks about when the P-38s came to the rescue.
Yes.
And then he talks about a time when you were going through clouds and you couldn't see. And then planes just started popping up and nobody hit anybody.
Oh, yes.
And then he talks about the Isle of Vis and landing.
Oh, he did mention that.
He did mention it, but he didn't talk about the 12 inches.
Oh, well, he wouldn't.
He said the field was only 1,800 feet long with a high cliff at one end and a saddleback on the other end. The saddleback had about a 30-degree slope on which the people farmed grapes. We had to drop down low over vineyards to land. There was no going around for another try because of the cliff at the other end.
Yes, yes. Oh, boy.
And then he talks about flying wing with a general was going to lead in the number one position.
Yes.
And another guy, let's see. Let me see here. Near the end of our mission and near the end of the war, everyone was trying to get as many missions in as possible to keep from having to go to the CBI theater rather than going home. I challenged our new operation officer for not putting us on the raids. Finally, he said, okay, you'll be on tomorrow. Well, he was going to fly position number two, and the general was going to fly us in number one. He put me on in number three position, which is probably the hardest position to fly because of having to fly cross cockpit, and we were not even used to flying a wing position. I told John that we'd fly her and show them we could do a good job, which we did. The weather was very rough and kept getting rougher all day long. Captain Dawson was going to show the general just how good he was, but he tried too hard because he was out and in all day. In fact, a lot of the time he would have his wing over the general's. On the way home from the target and about an hour out from home base, I told John that the general had seen that we could fly and it was getting so rough that for safety's sake we would move out. About that time, Captain Dawson thought, I'm sure, that, oh boy, I've got them now. We'll show the general just how good we are. He put his plane in really close to number one, and the general got scared he was going to hit his wing. He came on the radio and cussed, and I do mean cussed, Captain Dawson out. And then he talks about flying home and how, you know, how the storm was really bad, and they were supposed to fly without any sleep.
Yes.
And then he said he was afraid he'd be court-martialed, but he told the whoever was in charge that he wasn't about to fly with no sleep.
Uh-huh.
And so they let him sleep a couple hours, I guess, before he went home.
That's the way it was, yes.
So
we landed in I think we slept over in Italy. We went from the airfield that we were based at to the arch of the boot of Italy.
Uh-huh.
You know, it looks like a boot.
Right.
And there's a little town in there, I can't remember it, but I think we laid over there, and then in a few hours or whatever, we flew to Marrakech, French Morocco. And I'll never remember, I'll never forget, as we ascended down to the runway, I was behind the pilot, and I looked straight out like he was looking. And you know what a thermal wave looks like?
No.
On the air?
Oh, yes, I mean, yes.
All curly.
Right.
It was 30 feet above the ground, which meant, and when we got over there, it was 120 degrees.
Yes, he mentions
that's
that.
That's because we were standing in 120-degree heat in those thermal waves. Unbelievable. But then we took off and we went. Did he talk anything about the Azores Islands?
Yes, he said you flew to the Azores.
Yes.
And then he said, well, he talked about how hot it was, like you said, in French Morocco.
Yes.
And then he said we were flying instruments at the time. Oh, let's see. When we were coming in for a landing, I opened a window because it was so hot. Okay. The next morning, the three planes, Weir's, Thina's, and mine, headed for the Azores in the Atlantic, a bunch of tiny islands that on a map are hardly more than dots. I doubt if any one of the islands are 10 miles across. Anyway, it was nice flying until we got close to the Azores and ran into rain with poor visibility. I asked Lou Alexander, the navigator, for anything that might be in our way, such as high hills or mountains. He said there was nothing above our altitude, which was about 1,000 feet. We were flying instruments at the time, and we couldn't see very far at all. About that time, I glanced out and saw a mountain to our right. I never did find out how high that was, but it was above our altitude. We climbed to 500 feet and called on the radio to get bearings and to get clearance to land. We found the runway, which was 4 miles long and 6 feet above sea level, without too much trouble. We were glad to set down on it. We had to have a jeep lead us to parking, as it was so foggy we could not see any parking or any buildings. Does that sound right?
I don't remember landing in the Azores. I don't remember. I know how we got there.
Oh.
And we got there a lot different than Dick says we got there.
Uh-huh.
Because at that time, you know, pilots fly with, at that time, flew with a radio beam.
Uh-huh.
That's all they had for navigation. And on small planes, that's all they used was radio beam.
Mm-hmm.
And when we started to have airplanes and flying and commercial planes in this country, we had so many radio stations. So one beam went to the other and the other. The length of the radio beam that it could push that beam forward was 500 miles.
Mm-hmm.
500 miles west from French Morocco. That meant from there, let's say the Azores were halfway through, 6,000 miles across. That's 5,500, and then another 500. From 2,000 miles on the first leg of the flight, going towards the Azores, the pilot would be flying blind.
Wow.
So, kept asking me, what's the heading? And I kept telling him, it's 212. And he calls every 10 minutes, 212, Dick, 212. And finally, I got so exasperated with him that I'm looking back towards him from a bubble that's in above my workstation. And that bubble was there so that a navigator could take his... Hello?
I'm here.
Okay. Take his sextant at night and shoot a star. What does that mean, Fran?
I'm learning.
Okay. I have a portable phone. So I got up and looked right and John, the co-pilot, and I'd point with my hand, flat hand, and I'd say, that way, that way, that way, because I wasn't on intercom at that time.
Uh-huh.
And he wasn't happy. He wasn't happy for 2,000 miles each way, but the last two, he was a little happier. But imagine, the beam only went 500 miles.
Wow.
Look how we progress today, of course. They know everything today. But that was an experience. And I kept telling him, he says, why is it the same? Well, we flew the Great Circle route.
Mm.
And the Great Circle route simply means that on the globe, it looks like you're going over the North Pole, but you're not.
Uh-huh.
If you went, it's the shortest distance between two points.
Yeah.
That's how you get to the second point. Fly the Great Circle route. If you flew straight west, like if you're going to go from New York to California and you flew straight west up at that section, you'd land down in Southern California somewhere.
Uh-huh.
So that's why the Great... Anyway, we got there and we got back, and that's right. I felt very comfortable with him in the controls. I really did.
Well, he said that before you left Italy, were assigned the, we were assigned the plane that always had an early return. Something always was going wrong with it. Well, my engineer, Frank Letizia, and I went over that plane with a fine-tooth comb. Finally, we got down to cleaning the oil screens on the oil sumps. It was the night before we were to leave, but we stayed with it until we finished, which was in the wee hours of the morning. We rigged up lights and had cleaned three screens, and each one had been all right. Frank said, shall we take this one out? I replied, take it out. That last screen was completely clogged. We finished cleaning that up and got a couple hours sleep before we took off for French Morocco and Africa.
Wow.
And it says, we were flying, after eating, once in the Azores, after eating and finding quarters to sleep, some of our men had gone to a show. I was too pooped to do anything. About 10 p.m., while I was getting ready to go to bed, an orderly came in looking for me. He said we were to be in the line, the flight line, at 12 midnight for briefing, that we were going to leave here at 2 a.m. to fly into the States. He said the weather was getting worse, and they wanted to get us out of there before it got too bad. Well, I got Weir and Thena to back me up, and we were at briefing and had listened for 1.5 hours on how bad the weather was. I made up my mind there was no way they were going to get me to fly that night. There were about a dozen or so crews that were to leave that night, but all the rest had been there for a few days. At the end of the briefing, I addressed the colonel and told him we had just landed that evening, had had no sleep, and we three crews were not going to take off. By morning, the weather would either be better or worse, and if it was better, we'd go. If it was worse, I didn't want to be up in it, and it would be better flying in daylight anyway. Ordinarily, one doesn't tell a colonel what you're going to do. You do what he says. But I had good luck and didn't get court-martialed for disobeying his orders. He let us sleep from 2 a.m. until 4 a.m., have breakfast, and be on the line by 5 a.m. for briefing and takeoff. We did, we were, and we took off at 7 a.m. The weather was no worse, but it was no better. I learned later that three of the planes that took off at 2 a.m. never made it to Newfoundland. When we arrived over Newfoundland, St. John's Airport was socked in, so we had to fly on to Stephenville, which was an hour more flying time. We were very, very low on fuel by then. It was overcast at Stephenville, but they told us if we hurried, we might be able to make it. When we arrived, there was just one opening to let down through the clouds, and I dived her down through the hole and landed. Within 10 minutes of landing, it started snowing, and by morning, there was a foot of snow on the ground. After they plowed the snow off the runway, we took off for the good old USA. We flew down the St. Lawrence River. We could not tell when we flew over the mainland, as it was islands and water for miles. Finally, it got to be more land and less water, and then all land. All of the land was covered with trees. We could see nothing else. We landed in Connecticut. I can't remember the base. That's the last time... Pardon?
Stanley Field or something. I remember that.
He says, I can't remember the base. That's the last time I ever flew a B-24 and also the last time I saw all of my crew members. We were sent our separate ways by train for home for a furlough. After 30 days at home, I returned to Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, where I was reassigned to a B-29 base in South Dakota. Before shipping out, we were told if we had enough points, it seems we needed 30, they would let us out or discharge us if we had certain orders. I knew I had the orders, but I was so excited that I could not find them. I also knew that I had a lot more points built up than I would need. Finally, after looking through my papers many times and not being able to find the orders, I borrowed a set from a friend that were identical to mine, and that let me out. After I got out, I found mine. They were the first ones in the pile, but were upside down and backwards. Oh, hum. I sure was slipping, and I've been on the banana peel ever since.
Yeah. Did he have any flight time with the B-29?
No.
Or training? I didn't think so, because I got out the same way on points.
Yeah.
And they told me right up front, you got the points, so you don't have to worry. I said, oh, I'm not worrying, but I'm getting out, right? And they say, yes. I say, I'm getting out, right? And they say, yes. that's so interesting. That's really... Well, you know, when we hit the mainland of the hemisphere, like Newfoundland, I had very little contact with Dick on flying because he had the radio.
Yeah.
You see, and the radio beams were all over the place. But coming over that water, we became very good friendly enemies. I said, Dick, please give me a break. Well, we didn't use that taint phrase at that time, but he was something. I told the story to Harris. He might want to tell you it, but I think I'll refrain from telling you a story that was quite risque while we were flying across that water. But so that's good. All right. So now, how on Facebook? I have to get my youngest son to help me on this Facebook because I'm 20% computer literate and 80% not.
Well, I can give you the web address to go to the website. You don't have to be on Facebook.
Yeah, that's what I want.
So if you have a pencil, I'll give it to you.
I'm ready.
All right, Donna.
Who?
Donna, my name, D-O-N-N-A.
Donna, yes.
And Bayes, B-A-Y-E-S.
Oh, yes, B-A-Y-E-S, Scott.
Yeah, except Scott, I made this before I was Scott, so.
Oh, okay,
it's
so
just, it's DonnaBayes.com.
Oh, DonnaBayes.com, okay.
And then a slash.
A forward slash?
Yeah, the one aim to the right.
Yes.
And then Richard Sigel.
Okay. Fully spelled out, right?
Right. RICHARDSIGLE.
Yeah.
So it's
You pronounce it Sigel?
Well, Sigel.
Or Sigel.
Sigel.
I thought so. Yeah. I've been saying Sigel all this time. And, of course, when I saw the Army print, I realized it's there's no E there. It's Sigel.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, S-I-G-L-E. Okay.
One of the interesting things about, my website is I got an email from a gal whose father was one of the crew members. And it was James Cooper, I believe, the ball gunner.
Yes.
And she said that he had died, but he had never, ever talked about the war. They knew nothing about the war. And so one time she just decided to Google his name. And it came up to my website where she saw him listed as one of the crew members. And she got to read about stuff that she'd never known, and her whole family was excited about that.
Yeah.
And there were pictures of him, on my website and stuff like that. So I thought that was cool. And then I have on there a letter that my mom got from Frank Yannuzzi.
Yannuzzi, sure, Frank Yannuzzi.
Yeah.
Frank was, let me see now, here it is. Yeah, he was a waist gunner.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
And he wrote a nice letter to my mom, and it said, Lieutenant Sigel's professionalism brought us through a combat scene and back to the States. I looked at Lieutenant Sigel as the same as my father. Lieutenant Sigel had the leadership ability to complete any job at hand. As you know, we flew a B-24 back to the States from Italy and landed at Bradley Field, Connecticut. Very quickly, in a matter of a few days, I was placed on a train for Fort Sam Houston, Texas. The train was right there at the field. Lieutenant Sigel came to the train and said goodbye to me and to the others. That was the last time I saw him. Had he stayed with the military, he could have risen in rank up to colonel or general because he had all the ingredients and makeup to keep a military Air Force active. He maintained himself as one in a million. He was a pilot's pilot. Wasn't that nice?
Was this Frank that wrote it?
Yes.
The Frank that was on our crew?
Apparently.
Wow, is that articulate?
I know.
I didn't expect it of Frank. We had communication between enlisted men and officers, but not too much.
Yeah.
But I remember he was kind of a quiet guy, was smiling.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, that's something. That's great. Oh, that's so nice.
It was very nice. So I will, have you written down any of these stories?
That you just told me?
That you told me.
No.
You ought to.
I started to write like Dick did when he first knew he had cancer, you told me, I think, or your brother told
right.
me.
Right, uh-huh.
And I started to write. As a matter of fact, I have the pages right here. And I haven't gotten out of my elementary school yet. That's how far I've gotten.
Well,
I don't know. I'm maybe kind of a lazy guy. I'm possessed with music. I had a half-baked career as a singer, and my time is mostly taken with air. I was teaching, I was conducting a chorus, and family and outer family and listen, I haven't been diagnosed with cancer, however, but I still have an operation to go to, which is called achalasia, which means that my food and water does not get into the stomach.
Mm.
Which means, well, it does. But if it's serious and you're not on the right diet, you can lose weight and lose weight and lose weight and pass on. So, but fortunately for me, I've been able to maintain a weight.
Uh-huh.
I lost 65 pounds over a period of 6 months. My family hasn't got over that, but I feel wonderful.
Yeah.
Now, you know, and I'm looking forward to an operation. They're going to widen the esophagus for me. That's the problem.
Uh-huh.
You know, but I haven't had that urgency yet, so I don't know whether... If I have that urgency of your time is limited, Lou, I might be writing up a storm, too.
Well, I would love to add your stories to my website.
Well, okay, that's a motivation. Let me see what I can do with that.
Okay, and if anything that, you know, that you read on there that my dad wrote, but you have additional information, I would love to have that, too.
Okay, I know where you're coming from now. All right, now, what's your, how do I get that stuff to you? You have is email the best?
Oh, yeah, email works good.
Okay, email is what?
Donna.
What is, oh, you gave it to me.
No, I gave you the web address, but my email is donna@marykay.com. M-A-R-Y-K-A-Y. Mary K.
Oh, Mary K.
The cosmetic company.
K.com?
Yeah.
Okay.
And what's your email address?
My email is P as in Peter.
Uh-huh.
P as in Peter. Oh, my God. I just moved from an upstairs apartment to a downstairs apartment, and everything is chaotic. P-P-R-O-P.
Okay, P-prop?
Write it down. Hold on. P-P-R-O-P. P-prop. That's for pristine properties. I was in real estate.
Uh-huh.
Pristine. P-prop. 04 LOU dot no not dot
at
what's my server?
If you've got donna@marykay.com written down and you can email me, then I can get it from that.
That's right. That's right. Send email. Address also. Okay.
And if something happens with the website, you know, where you're not, it's not coming up for you, like maybe you have a misspelled word or something like that, If you go to Google and just type in Richard Sigel, maybe even Richard Sigel World War II or something like that, it will come up. The website will come up.
Okay. think all World War II. Opt online. It's at OPT. Online.net.
Okay. OPTonline.net?
Yes.
Okay. Great.
It's opt online. .net.
Okay.
So it's PROP04. That's when I started. My name, Lou. I don't know why I keep doing those things. At optonline.com. .net.
Okay. I've got it.
Yeah. All right. Good. All right. Well, we got a lot done here.
Yeah. And how many children do you have?
I have 3 children, 2 by my first wife, 1 by my second wife, and I'm married to a woman now. We just passed our 25th wedding anniversary, and without any children. Well, I brought my youngest son to the marriage, and she had a young teenage son and daughter also. So we brought up 3 kids.
Cool.
And that's the way it is. 3 marriages. Fran has had 2. My wife Fran marriages. But life has been hectic and exciting and beautiful.
Well, that's great.
You know?
Well, my dad had 5 kids.
Yes, I hear that. Right, 5. That's wonderful. 3 boys?
4 boys. 1 girl.
Huh?
I'm the only girl. 4 boys.
Oh, you spoiled brat, you.
Oh, no, I'm not spoiled.
Yes, she is.
You're not? You
no.
never were?
I never was. I had to fight for everything.
Oh, that's right. It's the boys that get spoiled. They're the only ones. I knew 2 guys that had 5 children, 5 sisters, or 4 or 3, and they were spoiled rotten. Oh, my God. They all wanted to mother them.
Yeah, that's right. So I didn't get spoiled.
Okay. They wanted you to play ball.
That's right.
Yeah, oh, that's good, Donna. That's great.
Well, I have thoroughly enjoyed visiting with you.
Me too. Let me ask you, did Dick ever get investigate our reunions?
You know,
I think
he went to a couple of them.
Did he really?
I think so.
Where were they? You remember?
You know, would there have been one in Nashville maybe or something? I'm not sure where they were, but I think he and my mom went to a couple.
Uh-huh.
Did you ever go? Did you go?
No.
Yeah.
No, I lost touch. I lost touch. I kind of blanked out the war, the military.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, there was, I keep saying, you know, the first time you... Who was the guy that said this was the greatest...
Generation?
Generation. Who wrote that?
He was the newscaster.
Yes, he retired.
Tom Brokaw.
Yes. Well, I never really took to that. You know, I said, well, I don't know. What's greater than facing death every day? I mean... Come on, give me a break. But then I think, I'm thinking that maybe there is something. Because, like, I don't recall that we run around saying rah, 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 as I mentioned to you, I think, about things that we did.
Uh-huh.
We never praised ourselves. We never... And did something like we got this guy, senator, that was trying to run for president, and he kept saying, shake hands with a hero. You know, hello?
Mm.
Shake hands with a hero? How dare you say that to try and get points? And so there was a time in one of our flights where a bombardier, but he was big. He was 6'2" or something. And at the end of the war, our last missions, we didn't have much resistance from the enemy.
Uh-huh.
So everybody was hanging out in the waist. Maybe the last few flights we got there. And he was bored, and he was bombardier, supposed to be up with me. But once he did what he had to do after the mission, and we were kind of way back, he jumped into the nose turret. The nose turret was for a guy 5'6" and under.
Hmm.
He gets in there, he cranks around, and he's squirming, he's moving the guns, he's pretending like he's shooting the two 50-millimeter machine guns, and I'm doing my work. After a while, I'm looking up there, and I don't hear this thing moving. Of course, you don't hear too much. I'm seeing his chin is on his chest. So I went through all hell to pull this guy's body out of there. His oxygen connection was severed. His electrical heating cord was not connected. So I said, well, what am I going to do with this guy? I propped him up next to me. I warmed his feet and hands and put my oxygen mask in front of him and hit him in the chest so he'd breathe and put it back on mine because at 35,000 feet you can't stay too long without. And I did all this thing. Finally he woke up and wanted to know what the heck I was doing with him. That's all right. So he got back. That was it. Well, my granddaughters take a real problem in saying to me, why didn't you report this? I said, what do you mean report it? He got out. We got him out, and he is all right. They wanted the applause.
Mm-hmm.
They don't understand. Now, this is when talking about 26-year-old people. My granddaughters are around that age, 24, uh-huh. 26. So, you know, that's what they want. And how could anybody not take the applause, take the reward, take the hero medal?
Mm-hmm.
What are you talking about, hero medal? He's one of our crew, and I'm going to leave him up there with his chin on his chest only to come back and do something? Is your father going to go from runway to runway over four lanes? And land the plane almost would have killed all of us because we had the 10 bombs fully armed and on board that emergency landing in this. Are we all going to run and do that? Maybe what Brookdale had is hit on something that I just couldn't connect with at the time. And I'm beginning to think maybe he is right.
Wow.
About it being a great American tradition,
yeah.
Generation. I don't know about the greatest, but certainly yeah. a great one.
It was, I think so. Were you was that Gene Kozinski who got up in the thing?
I tried to get him. And I left word with his mother. I called him in California. In California, he had 4 beauty parlors.
Wow.
Now, I don't know what happened to him. Did Dick get a hold of him?
I think we used to get Christmas cards from Kozinski and Serpico.
And Serpico? Oh, my God. That's great.
Now, whether they're still around, I don't know, but I think Serpico still is because that girl whose dad was Cooper, she was in contact with Serpico. I think she has an email address for him.
Uh-huh.
I ought to get that for you.
Okay. Wonderful. Gene was a character. Gene came from Hamtramck. Did you ever hear that name?
Uh-uh. No.
Hamtramck is like Harlem in New York.
Uh-huh.
Okay. The fully unintegrated, all people of color and trouble. It used to be not as much trouble as it is now because of the drugs.
Uh-huh.
Because I remember, because I went to Juilliard School of Music, which was around the corner from Harlem, 125th Street in Manhattan. And we used to walk up and down 125th Street And we used to go to the restaurants there. Nobody prodded you. But since the drugs, you can't risk it. Mm-hmm. And he grew up in a community like Harlem, where there were, well, he didn't say drugs, but there was a lot of crime. Mm-hmm. And he would imitate how a lot of those people with knives and guns would talk to you. It was funny. He was funny. John wanted to be a movie star.
Oh, really?
Serpico, yeah. He got in one movie. I don't know what it was. I haven't been able to get the full tape of it. I can't even remember the title. But that's what it was. And, you know, I wanted to be an opera star, opera singer, not star. And I did some. I did some good. I loved the music, and the melodies are just fantastic for me. The type of music that I love and learned and taught was what you heard in those three tenors.
Oh, yes.
Pavarotti. That's the style singing that, and you know, you need that style singing to do that kind of literature. So, that's my passion.
Well, that's
and,
great.
Other than that, there hasn't been much. And bringing my three kids up and a stepson since he was 10, we did a pretty good job with him. Hopefully he's doing good. He's married, has a son. Uh-huh. Has a son that has, what do you call it? He's got a condition called autism.
Oh, uh-huh.
You have that over around where you live?
Oh, yes. I don't understand it. It seems like you're hearing a lot about it now, and I don't remember hearing that much about it before.
Yeah. They're telling us what?
He's on the spectrum.
Oh, yeah. He's on the spectrum of the disease. And he is, we took care of him from 8 o'clock, well, my wife mostly, until 5 o'clock, every day since he was born up until a month or so ago. So, I mean, he's the love of my life. I don't care who a child is, if you have an opportunity to see him and deal with him every day of his life, you've got some religion in your body, I'll tell you that. You may not have had any before, but you had to figure it out, and I was one of those. I mean, I had religion, but I mean, it's just the mystery of life encompasses you,
mm-hmm.
possesses you, and this is what women have to deal with all the time. We went off to work. You know, when I think about my first two sons that I, and the third one with the second wife, that I didn't have that opportunity, that experience of being, dealing with them every day.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, you gals might have, a lot of gals that I know didn't like that idea, but and wanted to change it. I know one in particular that wanted equal chores given out to the husband, and so, well, they could do this and that, and, you know, I'm not against that kind of thing, but it is an experience. So, when I had the second child with the second wife, I found out what difference there is in parenting.
Yes.
And you try to make amends. And the second son, the third son with the second family, was still very, very close to, probably the closest one I have, except the second son of the first marriage was out in California. Anyway, listen, we have, I hope I can get the energy and the memory to to get some words out to you for your website.
I would love that. That would be great.
All right, Donna, and my portable phone is slowly fading.
Okay.
It's fading fast.
Okay.
All right?
All right. Well, it's good talking to you.
Thank you so much. All right?
All right.
I leave my word.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.